1994, and start by acknowledging the Quandamooka people who are the traditional custodians, the land on which we meet. I'd also like to pay respect to their elders past and present and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians who are present. Just a reminder for those in the public gallery, under our standing orders, we do have ways that you can operate here in a general meeting at Council. So all members of the public present at a meeting must, not without the prior approval of the chairperson, make any audio or video recording or take any photographs. Remain quiet and do not disrupt the meeting in any way. Not bring into the meeting any signs, placards or items that may cause a hazard or interfere with any other person present. Be suitably dressed and turn all mobile devices to silent mode and leave the meeting to take any calls. As chairperson, it's my responsibility to warn a member of the public that if you are not complying with these standing orders, that it is at my discretion to ask you potentially to leave the meeting, not just for this meeting. I can make that decision for future meetings as well. We have one leave of absence this morning, councillors. Councillor Gleeson is an apology, and we'll have that noted for Councillor Gleeson, Councillor Division 9. Moving straight on to our devotional segment, and it's with great pleasure, as always, that I ask a member of the Redlands Minister's Fellowship, Reverend Jim DeWitt, from the Redlands Christian Reformed Church at Ormiston, to lead us, Council, in a brief devotional segment. Over to you, Jim.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to lead this part of the meeting for you. It's a privilege that we get as the local churches, and we're incredibly thankful for it. And just want you to know that we're thankful for the work that you do as councillors, and as local churches, we pray regularly for you because we understand that it's not always an easy task to run a city and to keep people happy. I suppose it's a bit like a pastor in a church. You can never make everyone happy, but you do what's best for the city, as we do for our churches. Just to let you know that we do pray regularly for you. Just as a way of opening, if you got your invitation to, as councillors, to our next minister's fellowship breakfast, there was a little note in there about something that happened in America, and I just want to allude to it now. It was a Panama City beach in Florida. And there was a family, Roberta Uzuri and her family. They were out for a Saturday swim. I've got the news report here. And the beaches were, in a sense, closed, but they decided to go for a swim. And she comes out of the water and turns around, and her family are gone. And she's frantically searching for them, and they've been swept in a rip about 100 metres along the beach. And she's frantically trying to find out how to rescue them. But being a mother, and in the water was her sons, her nephews, her own mother and her husband caught in the rip. And so against the advice of people, she goes in to try and rescue them, as you do as a mother, and gets caught in the rip herself. So there are now 9 people caught in the rip. There was another family there at the beach, and they see that they're in trouble, and so they rally people together. And they say, we're going to rescue these people. And what they ended up doing is that they formed a human chain, about 80 people, linking hands together about 100 metres long out into the water, and they would go out and they would grab one and put them on the end of this line. They'd make their way back to the beach. And they rescued all 9 of the people. She says her mother actually had a heart attack, and they did CPR for her on the beach, revived her, and the whole family survived. And she says, I'm so grateful. These people were God's angels that were there at the right place at the right time. I owe my life and my family's life to them. Without them, we wouldn't be here. And the couple who rescued them says, look, that's humanity. That's humanity doing what we can to rescue each other and to save each other and linking hands together. And I referenced that recently in our church to what we do as a church, that we work together, we link hands together, and we do that to support and encourage one another, to look after one another. And in the Bible, it's 100 times there's the challenge to do things for one another. One third of them is about unity. And some examples are, be at peace with one another, accept one another, bear with one another, forgive one another. About a third of those are about love. Some examples, 11 times it says, love one another. It says, through love, serve one another. And there's a percentage of them that are about humility. Regard one another as more important than yourself. Serve one another again. And then some other ones that talk about judging one another, speaking the truth in love to one another. And we that's a challenge to us as a church community. But I think the same thing is a challenge to a city and to a council and to a community, that we link together, we work together, we support one another, and we do that in ways that create unity, that we do that for love for the city and for the people of the city. And so that's my challenge this morning, as you work together in this council meeting, that you do it for unity, you do that in love, you do that in humility, and you do that as you link hands for the good of the city. And that's our prayer as churches for you, and that will be my prayer for us this morning. So let me lead you in prayer. Lord, we thank you for this wonderful city, the Redlands, in which we live, that we call home. We thank you for the beauty of it. We thank you for the infrastructure we enjoy. We thank you for those who make it the place that it is. Lord, we thank you for our leaders. And Lord, we pray particularly this morning for our mayor and the assembled council here, for those in the public gallery who are contributing. Lord, we commit them to you. Lord, we pray that you grant them wisdom to govern well, to decide well in the midst of differing interests and issues. Lord, we pray that they will do this with a sense of welfare for the true needs of our city. We pray that they'll do that with confidence in what is good and what is right. We pray, Lord, that you'd give them the ability to link arms together, that they'll be able to do this in unity, even when there's honest disagreement. Lord, we pray for their own personal lives, that you'd give them peace in their lives, that you would watch over them and to give them health and strength so they can be there for their families, but also for this city. We pray for the agenda that's set before them, Lord. We pray that they'll wisely work their way through it. And Lord, that through this meeting, our city will be blessed, and that we'll be able to continue to enjoy what we have here. So Lord, thank you for these people. And we pray for your blessing in Jesus' name. Amen.
The next item on the agenda is our segment for recognition of achievement. And it's kind of a weird moment for me to today recognise someone that has been working in our office for 5 years. And generally speaking, this person would prepare for me the recognition of achievement for those other members in our community who we recognise publicly and thank them for their contribution. Today, I'd like to recognise David Smith, who has probably spent more time with us in council than he has with his own family in the last 5 years. He's well known to many people across both state government and local government, and has had a long career serving as public servant, serving people from both sides of politics, and in his most recent time, 5 years here, serving the community of Redlands through the Office of the Mayor. After a little bit of a fright, I suppose, with an illness which he's recovered from, he's decided that all these years serving us as politicians, it's time for him to enjoy some more time with his family. And I've just lost my notes, so I'm going to wing it, which is probably pretty easy. So today we recognise David Smith, not only for his 5 years of service, but we could all agree that his incredible loyalty and passion to what he does. Many of you would know that he would probably be one of the first people to arrive here in the morning and the last person to leave. And if you were ever to drop in for a small chat, councillors, you know that that would turn into a very long chat. But he's very respected, and he's brought a great opportunity to this city by his connections to state government, certainly helped put us on the map and help us be recognised, albeit that we continue to lobby for all those things we think are important to our city, but David has certainly helped. I know that he has many friends that he has retained over his service to state government and to to local government, and that is just a testament to the fact that he has always been fair, honest, upfront, and easy to work with. And you can talk to any minister, previous or existing, that has worked with David, and he comes very highly recommended, whether it be the Blues or the Reds or the Greens or the Pinks, for want of a better word. So, David, if I just could ask you to come forward and on behalf of all of council and the community, serving in the office of the mayor is not an easy task. He takes a lot of the bullets for all of us. I'd just like to give you a small, I guess, recognition of your service to council. We're going to catch up later and perhaps celebrate that a little bit more. But we know that the time that you'll now take away from sitting in the office here will be spent with your beautiful grandchildren and your beautiful wife and family. And it's been a real honour and privilege for me to work side by side with you, David, and I will miss you. Councillors, item 5 is receipt and confirmation of minutes, that the minutes of the general meeting held on the 12th of July 2017 be confirmed. Could I just ask for a mover? Moved Councillor Bishop, seconded Councillor Tolte. Any items of correctness? There being none, I put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Item 6 is matters outstanding, and there are none, so councillors move straight on to public participation. I haven't been advised of anyone wanting to address council this morning. I'll just double check in the public gallery if there's anyone wishing to address us. There being none, I'll move straight on to what would normally be item 9, councillors. I am going to, in respect of the wonderful men in Paris Blue in the back, try and move this agenda around so that we can deal with some of the items that they're involved with, and also put a presentation to the end of today's agenda. So I'm going to ask for a change in the order of business, and I think Councillor Edwards has got an extra one to put in there, Councillor Bishop. So are you ready for that, Councillor Edwards? That item 8, petitions and presentations, as listed in the agenda, be listed as the last item of business. So moved, seconded by Councillor Bishop. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried. I also need another mover and seconder that item 16.21, the Redland City Council Fire Management Plan Review 2017, be listed as the first item of business. So moved, Councillor Boglari, seconded Councillor Edwards. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Okay, so that brings us to our presentation from QFRS. I might just ask Mike Lowell back to come forward, but at the same time, while that's happening, councillors, ask that permission be granted for representatives of Queensland Fire and Rescue to present on the first item of business, Redland City Council Fire Management Plan Review 2017. Could I have a mover and seconder? Moved Councillor Boglari, seconded Councillor Mitchell. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. Now, just before we head into those reports, Councillor, just quickly a reminder at Section 10 of your material personal interest and conflict of interest. Those responsibilities are listed in your agenda and fall under the Local Government Act 2009. And with that, we'll move straight on.
Just wondering, do we need to make a vote for leave of absence?
That's been done, Councillor. It's not a leave of absence. Apology has been noted. That was done right at the beginning of the agenda. So moving on then, we'll bring forward item, the first item of business being the Redland City Council Fire Management Plan Review. I'll ask Michael Olbeck to introduce the QFRS.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Good morning, councillors and members of the gallery. Today is quite an important day for us across Redland City, not just within council, but for the broader community, in that we will be receiving the fire management report completed by Training and Emergency Management of Queensland Fire and Emergency Services, as was an undertaking given by this council to the January 25th general meeting, that we would embark on a engagement of a group to undertake a independent review of council's fire management and disaster management practices. Indicative of the outcomes of that review is the presence of members of Queensland Fire and Emergency Services in the room today. And I draw attention from the gallery and to the councillors, particularly to the people who have represented us here today, to demonstrate to the community what the commitment to the safety of members of Redlands is, both within this council and across the broader sector. And we very much appreciate that this important day has been recognised not only within council but more broadly by Queensland Fire and Emergency Services in the work that has been completed. To commence today, I think it's important that we do acknowledge the fact that the independence of this particular review has also been directly assisted by members of the Southern Moreton Bay Islands Combined Islands Association, and their work in this area has been invaluable to us in gathering information and being able to receive a truly independent review that has been based on the views and opinions of people who live on the island, on the physical observations made by the reviewers. And that report is proudly released today on the basis of a document that will help define council's future in the mitigation and the safety of its citizens, in ensuring that fire management is part of council's absolute core business in all its facets. To commence with the day, I'd like to firstly, ma'am, introduce to you Deputy Commissioner Mark Roach, Assistant Commissioner Andrew Short, and Superintendent Andrew Sprizzi, the commander or the officer in charge of training and emergency management, who initially would like to present to you, ma'am, the report that has been completed in a formal fashion. Could I invite you forward, sirs, so that you might be able to make that presentation? Just down the front.
I would like to, on behalf of Queensland Fire and Emergency Services, and we have representatives here from Fire and Rescue Service, State Emergency Service and Rural Fire Service, to present to you this independent review. With the independent review goes 56 recommendations, which looks at the analysis of the vulnerability of communities and also about fire management planning. So we believe that this is a good report and it provides the council with an opportunity to then take this to the next level. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I think it's also important in the presentation today that some indication of exactly what this report is all about is being able to present it to you. So I'd like to invite forward Station Officers Ian Moore and John Fullard, who were our lead reviewers on this particular document, who might be able to present to you a little bit of what those recommendations are all about. And then I'll give you a very quick overview of what Council is doing at this present time to be able to advance on those.
Thank you very much, Madam Mayor. Morning again, Madam Mayor and Councillors, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ian Moore and I have been the lead manager of this particular project and the report that we're going to present to today. To my left is John Fullard, who is my colleague in actually preparing this particular document. Now, if I could start off by giving you a little bit of background on the document itself. For those of you who have actually now seen the physical copy, the report consists of two parts. There is the main body document, and then there is the annexure. The annexure is a very technically based document that has a significant amount of work that has been done by our predictive services unit. It is geared very much for a technical type analysis, dealing more with specialists within the field of conservation and fire mitigation. I will not be actually entering into this particular document today. However, there were some conclusions reached within this document that have been actually drawn from that and actually placed into the main body of the document. So this document is the one that we'll be discussing today, which is the review of the fire management plans. Also, just to give you a little bit of background of who John and I are, to add, I suppose, some context to our ability to produce this report. Combined, we have 45 years in the fire service, with myself being 30 years in the Country Fire Authority and Queensland Fire and Emergency Services, focusing largely on wildfire mitigation and dealing with prescribed burn activities. So we come to you with the ability to be able to present the findings. Also, it's very important to understand how we've reached the conclusions that we have, which obviously have guided us to our recommendations. This review was being built very much from a community protection standpoint. And in order to achieve our outcomes, we consulted with a significant number of community members. Approximately 200 members in total were communicated with across the southern Moreton Bay Islands, and they provided feedback through a number of means, primarily an online survey and a number of online meetings at people's residence and also at community events. So that's all of the findings within our review. So we will go through our findings now. Today, the summary of the review, Council originally tasked the Training and Emergency Management Department to present the review, and it was to be rolled out in a number of phases. The first phase was to focus on the southern Moreton Bay Islands, and on completion of that unit, we were then to proceed onto the mainland of the Redlands, and there was an optional third phase which was never actioned, which was to investigate Stradbroke Island. The scope of work is there in front of you right now to review the current maintenance plans of the southern Moreton Bay Islands, review the vulnerability of the level for the southern Moreton Bay Islands, review impacting legislation requirements, collect and verify mapping data, review fire access trails, and then ultimately to produce the report. Just as a summary, we have raised 56 recommendations for Council's consideration. So our findings today are going to be presented in general groups that we're going to be terming as chapters for consideration by Council. These chapters have already been actioned or given some consideration by Council, and as speaking to Mike Lolbach, we understand that many of the recommendations have already been partially actioned or at least investigated. So going through, chapter one is the local laws and legislation. Now, according to the survey that we did of the Southern Moreton Bay Island residents, we have identified that 40% of the residents misunderstand what the intent is of the local laws that govern their community. Particular focus is on Local Law 3 and Local Law 6. There is a distinct seeming conflict in those two laws in the eyes of the residents in Redland City Council, especially on the Southern Moreton Bay Islands. And our own assessment of those local laws support that the Local Law 3, which is focusing on the community environment management, does seem to be in conflict of Local Law 6, which is protection of vegetation. So moving on from there, other local law and legislation issues is the seemingly reactive method of local law enforcement across the southern Moreton Bay Islands predominantly. A number of cases were raised by residents where council were asked to come and investigate particular situations. On their arrival, council came, they managed that particular issue that was raised by the residents, but then they drove out, passing multiple cases of similar, if not worse, conditions of a variety of cases. Some of the issues that council would have driven past, substandard building, overcrowing blocks, illegal dumping and hoarding. And I'd like to sort of point out that effectively the standard that you walk past is the standard that is deemed to be accepted, and residents are obviously looking at council to lead the way. Moving on to Chapter 2, which is illegal dumping and hoarding, raised in the last slide. This is a particular concern primarily on Russell Island, to a lesser degree on the other islands. Karragara is the only island that I witnessed that was really pretty much exempt from these sorts of issues. The illegal dumping consists of a multitude of types of dumping, all the way from car bodies, industrial waste, green waste, and household wastage. In total, we witnessed in excess of 40 vehicles dumped across Russell Island and Macleay Island. The impact of all of this illegal dumping and hoarding definitely does impact on the unpredictable nature of wildfires when they occur. It also increases the health risk to our residents. The potential environmental risks are significant, and they obviously encourage vermin. Chapter 3 is the maintenance plans and access trails. This is more focusing on the fire management plan that Redland City Council currently has to manage your fire hazards. Now, what we have identified is that I'll go on the record for saying that the conservation team were witnessed to be doing an exceptional job of the tasks that they were doing. The jobs that they have been given were done to a very high standard. However, both John and myself witnessed in our own observations, supported by residents in our visits, that there are significant areas of concern. And these are primarily focused around what is classed as a fire exclusion zone. And I'll just point out that a fire exclusion zone is a term that is actually used by council. It is not a Queensland Fire and Emergency Services term, and it is actually drawn from your fire management plans. And essentially, a fire exclusion zone is an area of land that has been deemed is not capable or suitable to have fire into that area for a multitude of reasons that I'm not aware of. In some cases, those fire exclusion zones will not actually support fire because they are in swamplands, marshland or rainforest. However, there are many areas of those fire exclusion zones that are carrying fuel that is definitely of a nature and form that would support wildfires. And what we have identified is that in some of those fire exclusion zones, there is a total fuel loading of in excess of 30 tonnes per hectare. Now, that probably doesn't mean much on its own, but if I draw your attention to the bottom blue area, within Queensland, the general accepted fuel loadings for vegetation is 20 tonnes per hectare would be considered very high, too extreme in urban or semi-urban areas, of which the Southern Moreton Bay Islands are. So you can see the very significant increase in those ecological zones. Just to draw you, for those who are unaware of where these zones may be, this is just an example. This does not suggest that these are the only exclusion zones in the council. This is the southern end of of Russell Island. And all of the areas that are in olive colour, a yellowy colour there, are exclusion zones, meaning that fire does not go into those areas. They are in many cases adjacent to or in close proximity to your residence, and they are carrying excessive fuel loads. At this point, we have been unable to determine what council's plan was moving forward, but we are seeing an excessive fuel load in there that must be managed in order to preserve the safety of the community. In addition to the fuel loadings, many of those fire exclusion zones have limited access trails for fire authorities to actually use to gain rapid access, and there is, in many cases, more predominantly on the mainland, some of the exclusion zones actually have external perimeter tracks that do not meet the requirements for a block or an area that is carrying the fuel loading that it is. Chapter 3, Continuing Fire Index. This is where we would, both John and I and our predictive services team, would like to encourage council to adopt a method of measure to identify are your plans working and what should we be actually planning for. The Fire Danger Index is a term used by the Fire Service in Australia to determine fire risk or rating, and it's a numerical value that's ascertained by comparing wind, temperature, relative humidity and a number of other factors, and when combined give us a figure. This table at the base, which you may or may not be able to read from where you are, indicates that within the southeast area of Queensland, these readings are taken from Brisbane Airport, which is the closest weather station that we can accurately use for our weather determinations, have indicated that there are 9 days per year where the FDI level in the area reaches 20. There are a number of days, approximately 3 to 4 days per year, that would be in excess of FDI 20. However, all organisations must obviously draw a line and identify a statistical and beneficial level to build their plans on. We can't guarantee 100% safety in every single case. So FDI 20 has been elected by predictive services and our QFES team as the ideal level the council should be maintaining their preparation to. That would include their prescribed burning frequency, fire access trails, community education, and a number of other activities that could leverage off that as being the platform. Very quickly, to put it in context, for those familiar with the Russell Island fire, that day was FDI 8. So you would be aware it was a very significant fire event that involved a significant number of resources. That was FDI 8. So FDI 20 is somewhat higher than that. Continuing through, the Predictive Services Unit has utilised some cutting-edge technology that Australian Fire Services are using to predict fire spread. That is a program that is called Phoenix. They have adopted that program, engaged some other formulas to create what we are calling the Sabre Bushfire Analysis Tool. And what this tool will do is enable council to use this as a preparation tool to gauge risks at a certain level, identify trouble spots and put in relevant steps to mitigate those. One of the questions right back on the first slide was, are your current prescribed burn plans actually providing value and are they programmed to the maximum benefit to community? Unfortunately, we can't answer the second part, which is the maximum benefit to community, because it involves computer power and formulas that just don't exist yet. However, what we can tell you is that on the southern Moreton Bay Islands, when we have applied the formula and this program across the islands, that the current prescribed burn program is providing benefit to the residents of southern Moreton Bay Islands. It generates approximately a 100 hectare benefit across the islands. That's not a hard and fast figure. It's more of a gauge to say that, yes, our plans are working. What I can say, though, is there is definitely room for improvement. Moving that across to the mainland, the same formula applied sees a total improvement of approximately 200 hectares. Again, this is actually not so much working on where fire will impact, but where is fire actually able to be mitigated or rather attacked by our fire services. So your plans are actually having an impact, but there is room for improvement. Chapter four, is the low resilience of disaster prepared management of your southern Moreton Bay Islands. Our survey has indicated that approximately 45% of your residents have not accessed the Redland City Council Disaster Management Plan. That is a very extensive document, but obviously we've got almost half of our population on these SIMBYs that have not, for whatever reason, engaged in that. Part of one of those recommendations is a bushfire survival plan. Now, potentially this is because of the good work done by council, the Rural Fire Service, and also their recent impact from wildfires. One component is for them to have a personal bushfire survival plan, and we're happy to say that there is almost 75% uptake, but it still leaves 25% of the population that currently do not have a plan and they live in a very unique area. So consideration should be given to that. Chapter 5 is emergency response capabilities across the agencies. We've identified, I'm sure you would all agree, that the Southern Moreton Bay Islands present a unique risk in as much as that they do not have rapid support from other agencies. They are essentially isolated well within their island, and anything else must come by water. We have identified that each island does have the capacity to provide a good fire coverage, typically with a single appliance response, and in some cases they will have a second appliance available to respond should sufficient personnel exist. However, what we did identify through discussions with each of the rural brigades is that the islands have a desire to support one another, but currently there is no rapid way to deploy personnel from one island to the next. There were a number of stories that were given to us on the island that backed up that claim, but really it was identified that there is no rapid way of moving personnel from an unaffected island to the affected island. From the mainland, we're looking at a 1 hour plus delay on getting resources across there. We're talking at about an appliance now. We can get personnel there a little quicker, but to move an appliance is approximately an hour. It's a common misconception that helicopters are going to save the day, that we can just put more air resources in to combat the fire, but air resources only work if we have ground crews to support them. So if we have one single crew, we could put five helicopters on the island, but it's really not going to do much to alleviate the issue. The final area, Chapter 6, is access to fire hydrants and other water sources. I will say that as far as our identified risks, this is definitely the lower end. However, there were still some issues identified. On the southern Moreton Bay Islands, you have an extensive array of fire hydrants that are the envy of the mainland. Our dilemma is that many of them are placed in areas that are inaccessible due to poorly or not formed roads at all. There were also some examples where the retail precincts on the island where some hydrants that would probably be more useful for protecting that urban infrastructure are inaccessible due to parking and other matters. The council could assist in this. I know you do have resources on the island. Again, potentially leveraging off that FDI 20 as maybe a trigger, council could give consideration to utilising some of your resources to assist the fire service to supplement water through tankers or the likes. So at that point, ladies and gentlemen, those were the six areas that we investigated in chapter forms. And with the Mayor's permission, is there any need for questions today, Madam Mayor?
Look, I think it's fair to say that we had questions asked yesterday. This was an opportunity for us to have presented to the community what was presented to us. I'm going to thank the fire officers for coming back and doing that, because I think the presentation gave a great summary of some of our challenges, not just for us, but for individuals and for other levels of government, etc. So thank you very much, and I'm going to hand back to Mike. So we won't take questions now, but certainly we'll move into formal session once Mike's summed up.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Councillors and members of the gallery, once the formalities of this meeting are completed, the Mayor will be raising some questions with the councillors to be resolved in terms of the public release of this document, and we'd be hopeful that document would be released towards the end of this meeting so that the public can digest the things that are in there. Importantly to note, there was mention there made about North Stradbroke Island. It's important that you realise that North Stradbroke Island has not been ignored. In the gallery today we have Superintendent Paul Durston and Superintendent Fergus Adrian from the Rural Fire Brigade and from Queensland Fire and Emergency Services. They are the joint chairs of the North Stradbroke Island Fire Management Group, a multi-agency group that was established, or re-established, I should say, after the bushfires in 1415. And it's fair to say that the island is well managed, well contained. Obviously, in the discussions we've had with them across the multiple 10 years of ownership on the island, a very strong provision is put into place for the management of that island. So we did not see that as necessary in this review. There were more immediate concerns that had to be looked at. It's also important to note in terms of the review that the Queensland Fire and Emergency Services have indicated that whilst work continues on the island as being carried out across the whole of Redland City, there is room for improvement. And it may be gratifying, Madam Mayor and members of the Council, to recognise that at this point in time, across the 56 recommendations, we've determined that 27 of them have actually commenced. 27 of those recommendations, not as a result of the report, but as a result of the fires late last year, were taken on board by Council and included into a program of delivery. We will be asking, however, that the rest of the recommendations be looked at in situ by council officers, because the reality of it is fire management is not the responsibility of one group of people, it is the responsibility of everybody. And of course, what came very strongly in the report we saw was that a shared responsibility between council, the community and other tiers of government becomes critical in us ensuring that the safety of the residents is at the highest possible level. In that regard, the Mayor and the Chief Executive Officer have forwarded letters to various departmental heads and to ministers across both state and federal government to seek that whole-of-government approach. I'm pleased to be able to tell you at this stage we have heard back from the Federal Minister for Communications, from the Queensland Reconstruction Authority, and from the Department of Local Government, all of whom have asked to meet with us to talk about how they can help advance some of the issues that are in there. So it's very gratifying for us, in partnership with Queensland Fire, to acknowledge that the work is not something that we are planning for the future. It has started. It has very much become the core business of this organisation to seek improvement, to implement some of those modern technologies that our presenter spoke to about, technologies that are available in July 2017 that were not available in July 2016. And so keeping pace with the changes of technology will keep us in pace with the safety of our community. And in closing, Madam Mayor, before I hand back to you, I'd like to also, to Mr Roach, to the Assistant Commissioners in the room, Mr Short and Mr Heppel, particularly to pass on our thanks to you directly and to acknowledge and to bring to your attention the absolute professionalism of Superintendent Sprizzi and his team in their delivery of this work. It has been a pleasure to work with them, and that pleasure has also been passed on to us by members of the community who have also indicated that the work they have done has been quite outstanding. So, Madam Mayor, on that note, I'd like to hand back to you.
Thank you, and I note that we will continue to work with you in order to not only respond to the recommendations, but to ensure safety across the city when it comes to fire management. So thank you so much. Councillors, I now need to move back into our formal session and have a mover and seconder. We didn't actually suspend orders, so that's all good, but I do need to move to item 16.2.1. And there is a motion on the board, I believe, that and I'll just move this chair. And in just explaining to the public gallery, council has elected not to go into confidential session. We had it in confidential session in our agenda until we received the report officially, out of respect to the officers that have worked on it. But council has agreed that we will discuss this in public forum. Councillor Edwards, would you like to move that motion?
Thank you. Fire Management Plan Review 2017. I move the recommendation as written on the screen.
Thank you, Councillor Edwards, and it's seconded by Councillor Bishop. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Edwards?
I think most of it was addressed in the excellent presentation that we've seen. Reflecting on where we've come from with those fires that happened at that particular time, to reach to this stage, having an excellent report and an understanding of the fire risks is certainly something worthwhile. I'd also like to just take the opportunity to recognise the work that was done in those fires by the volunteers on the ground who did an amazing job. And we had two sets of fires. And
Could I ask you to ask the gallery to be quiet?
If I could just perhaps get some focus back onto the debate. Thank you, Councillor Edwards.
Yes. I'd like to again acknowledge the excellent work that was done on the ground by those the volunteer fireys on during those two fires. And it's important to reflect upon that both those fires, not one person was injured and there was no loss of property. And so I think that's an excellent result. But now having these additional recommendations, which we'll go through, and I understand that some are already in place, and we're looking at, with this recommendation, further implementations will be done. That really improves the fire security levels, not only on the islands but in the Redlands, and I think we're all very pleased to see this report come about.
Any speakers against? Questions or comments? I don't know that I've got anyone to answer your questions right now. My understanding is it's been presented and it's released. Correct. So, well, you can do that. I think you've had a presentation and you're quite entitled to speak to that presentation, councillors. Well, I don't have, depending on who's in the room to answer them, I'm mic's back, so that's okay. All right, so I think I had Councillor Bishop up first, Councillor Tolte. Well, councillors, I did ask for speakers against and now I put up their hands, so this isn't speaking, this is asking questions or comments. I'll go around the room, councillors, and that way you all get your say. Councillor Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Given that some of the matters that we have been able to identify that have been raised in the report can't really be spoken about, I'm sort of dancing on eggshells a little bit.
So you can speak to what you had in that report was the summary. Sorry, on the presentation was a summary of the report.
Yes.
Okay. So you can speak to that.
So one of the things that was raised yesterday, a question was, I'm speaking on behalf of the QFES officer, Ian, who presented yesterday, and I asked the question in response to the report about how council should manage going forward the balance between the essential management of infrastructure and looking after people's needs in future, because if we take all of the recommendations, we would probably seek to remove all the fuel loads that are there, and that could have some significant impacts on the vast areas of this city that we do manage. And I think that needs to be understood, balanced in a way that ensures that people and flora and fauna are managed in a balanced approach. And so I know that the officers are moving forward with some specific responses to these recommendations. I think it's important that we, as councillors, are entrusting our officers to go forth and do whatever compliance they need to in order to ensure that people are safe, but also that we need to find a balance now between those areas that are with exclusion zones, and manage that in a way that is looking after the significant estate that we have. I also think that encourages us to look back with purpose and clarity about the matters of local environmental significance and how we think about that across the city, because there are some significant issues that we need to address. I also think that it's important we acknowledge that there are people living in conditions on the island that we as a city need to be mindful of, and I've mentioned this with other councillors. We need to be mindful of how we design opportunities for accommodation for residents in this city who are in a situation where the income they have might not allow them to live in what is the market affordable housing accommodation that starts at $300,000 or $350,000. And we need to, as designers, do something that the market is currently not providing, because it does seem that people are moving to Southern Moreton Bay Islands and they are putting themselves in a situation that's endangering themselves and potentially the environment that we need to manage. So I'd like to see those two things, matters of local environmental significance, bolstered, and the issue of affordable accommodation turned into a conversation that the whole community can participate in. Thank you.
Councillor Elliott.
Just going back to this as confidential, council has determined that they don't want it to be confidential. I think you could, that the officer's recommendation not be accepted. And we discussed the report. This is rubbish to me. This is a significant report. It's going to be a significant resource issue. And council determines whether it's going to be confidential or not.
I'm taking advice in regards to our standing orders and how we deal with this. So
yeah, but it was put. There's nothing in the document. It says something. Hang on, the agenda. No. In the agenda, you've got conditions for. It says this particular one is H, other business for which a public discussion would likely to prejudice the interest of local government or someone else or enable a person to gain a financial advantage. None of those apply.
Thanks, Councillor. I'll seek some advice. I personally have no issues with discussing the report. One of the reasons why we all agreed that we should be discussed in the public forum, but unfortunately we have processes and standing orders that we have to try and address at the same time. So, General Manager.
It's currently confidential because that's the way that it's been through the system until you vote on it to decide that it's not confidential. So if once you move second and adopt this, then it becomes non-confidential. So I guess that the Chair or the Council could adopt that if that's their will, and then suspend standing orders to allow everyone to have their say, and then we go back into the formal business. If that was the will of the majority, that could be done. So you probably wanted to deal with this item first and then deal with suspension of standing orders to allow people to speak. Could be done.
I will, however, warn councillors that suspension of standing orders, I will be trying to run an efficient meeting and having those, you know, making sure that everyone's getting a fair say, but not labouring, you know, beyond what is fair to everybody else. So look, I'm more than happy to do that, councillors. Like I said, we had agreed in principle to do that. I'm just needing to deal with the processes that we're faced with. So we have a mover and seconder. If we can maybe take a vote on receiving the report and the and updates on the progress, etc., and I'll put that motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried unanimously. I'll need a mover now to suspend standing orders. Move Councillor Edwards, second to Councillor Boglari. Those in favour? Those against? Okay, in light of that, we'll continue around the room. And once again, councillors, please be respectful of time and other people who want to have a say.
But Councillor Bishop, is he happy that he's finished now, that this has been lifted, sort of thing like that?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I know that the officers are going to be going on with a lot of the responses to recommendations. I think it's one thing I would like to say is it's tremendous that this report has brought to light some pretty big rockets that we need to act on. And I think that we can encourage our officers to have every support in doing that, and it's also going to need to be a balance between the officers in the environmental space and with our residents in future. So I'll leave others to speak. I've had a bit of a say. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Tolte.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Well, first of all, I would commend both Council's officers and particularly our disaster management team under Michael Olbach for all the work that they've done, both in regard to helping to facilitate this report and work over the last 5.5 years I've been in council. And I'd also like to thank you for your leadership. You've been there the whole way through at public meetings up in Mount Cotton, talking to people about this fire mitigation issue and the risks. And the staff have come along to Mount Cotton Community Christmas Party every year for the last 5 years. And any event that's been on at the school or any other event that I've flagged where we might be able to spread the word about the community's risk and the need for an understanding of fire management plans and emergency management plans, and they have been there without question on Saturdays and Sundays, and some days it's been when they've already done nights and full weekends. So that's been really great. The report is very well written. I won't suggest that I understood all the technical aspects in the technical report, but I would like to understand that further, so I'll be asking Mike a few questions about that later on. In relation to the report and the officer's brief on the report, I've got a few questions and a few things that I'd like to comment on. So in the officer's note that sums up the independent report is noted that the review evaluated the level of vulnerability to wildfire across the Redlands city. However, the report had specific regard for Simbi, and that's fine because Simbi certainly needed this review. I am, however, disappointed at the limited amount of attention that the needs of mainland Redland did have in this report. There is, however, a clear indictment in this report that more needs to be done both on the islands and the mainland. And the report does clearly note that the recommendations across the Simbi and mainland are largely interchangeable. I won't speak so much to Simbi. I'll let Councillor Edwards do that as the representative for Simbi. But as the representative for Division 6, which covers most of the most vulnerable areas in Redland Bay, Mount Cotton, Sheldon, I'll be speaking to those aspects of the report that relate to mainland Redland. I certainly applaud the setting up of the SABRE bushfire analysis tool. That will help the future mitigation planning and allow tracking and a level of success in future mitigation planning and activities. However, I note that starting from where we are today, the recommended mitigation activities, which will reduce the level of risk for Redland Bay by minus 72 hectares, Mount Cotton by minus 18 hectares, Alexandra Hills by minus 9 hectares, and Sheldon by minus 8 hectares, will take until 2027 to be achieved. I call your attention, councillors, to the following points in the report. Under education and awareness, it is noted on page 66 under 4.3 that the level of preparedness is based largely on assumptions for the mainland because there wasn't enough time and resourcing in the report to be able to go further. Really, the only education that the officers were able to draw on was the assumption that children at the schools have likely received some education through programs on bushfire awareness and home survival plans. I would like to further bring to your attention the mapping in the report, which shows without significant mitigation action that Redland Bay and Mount Cotton, including the entirety of Mount Cotton Village, are at risk of loss in a wildfire. I absolutely support the review of the fire exclusion zones and note that the report suggests that greater community resilience would be achieved with a more community-based fire safety and education program. I would remind councillors that just last month we didn't support, well, some didn't support,
point of order, Mayor,
an opportunity to introduce a rural fire education and mitigation.
Councillor Hewlett, you will follow the standing orders. You've called a point of order. Councillor Hewlett, what exactly is your point of order? Okay, thank you. So what is your point of order? Refer to your standing orders and please... Thank you, Councillor Hewlett. Councillor Hewlett, I'm asking you for some silence while I ask what the point of order is. Councillor Tolte, I'd ask you to stick to the item in front of us, please, and not refer to any other decisions, etc. This is about
Madam
today's...
Mayor, on the report, on page 76, it says, it is the opinion of the project team that greater community resilience would be achieved with a more community-based fire safety and education program.
Thank you.
If that is not directly related to a fire mitigation and education unit through rural fire for the mainland, then I don't know what is.
Well, it may be indirectly related, but at the moment we're talking to the report, Councillor, so I'll ask you to continue. Thank you. There was no point of order because you didn't tell me what it was, but I'll ask the councillor to stick to the report. Thank you.
Which I believe I'm doing. Conflict between local laws and general perception by landowners that they cannot manage their risk because of council's bylaws is a significant problem, and I look forward to figuring out how we're going to address that. In conclusion, the report notes at page 75 that it would seem that ecosystem values are being prioritised above public safety. It goes on to note that this is not an intent but rather a confluence of factors over time, but it still remains within the community as a concern, and the fact that it's now been evidenced by the build-up of fuel loads within the public and private bushland is significant. And this is what my residents have been telling us for years. We currently have fuel loads in excess of twice what is recommended in the bushland around Redlands Hospital, and I note the images in the report that show similar fuel loads throughout Redland Bay, Mount Cotton and Sheldon. Officers have explained that fuel loads greater than 16 tonnes per hectare are considered excessive, And we have had identified through this report significant areas that have in excess of 20 tonnes and in some cases greater than 30 tonnes per hectare around the Redlands Hospital. I'll leave it there, Madam Mayor. I have got some questions about the connection between the requirement for a rural fire service on the mainland of Redland and in instituting the recommendations in this report.
That's okay, thank
you,
Councillor.
However, I'll keep asking, Councillor.
All right, Councillors. Councillors, if we continue, I'll be asking that we move out of our open session and we go right back into our formal session, and I will chair the meeting according to standing orders. I ask for respect from each of you and how you're dealing with yourselves in this opportunity to talk to this report. That means each and every one of you. Please sum up, Councillor Tolte. Thank you, Councillor Tolte. Councillor Hughes.
Thank you, Mayor. I would like to just highlight my concern with the recommendation that we have just moved. Point two, we talked into the three...
Point of clarity, we haven't moved any recommendations. We've agreed to receive and respond to them, just to be clear.
Within the 3 months time frame is in the motion.
We'll respond to those recommendations.
And I'm just pointing out that was my concern, that the 3 months did seem a little short to myself on asking the questions we have been assured. And we have amended that officer's recommendation slightly. We've added the word progress. So I would like to draw to the community's attention that quite often they might feel that there's 56 recommendations here and they're looking for an answer on all 56. We've already started and are working on 27 recommendations prior to receiving this report, and in the three-month time frame, our CEO, Mr. Chesterman, will be responding on a progress report and action report. So I wanted to highlight that. I also would like to see in our media release, when that goes out, on this report and our improvements to the community safety that we are looking at, that we have a little more detail. Sometimes the numbers and, for an example, 88,000 square metres, sometimes numbers can mean very little to someone. If we can get some a basic understanding of what really that means in our media releases, I'd be very happy. Thank you.
Councillor Elliott.
Thanks, ma'am. Look, this is not a good look for council. We can dress it up all we like. I congratulate putting our heads on the chopping block. We didn't have loss of life, but the report generally indicates that we need to do significant work. And I realise we can talk to other people about people living in bushes and under trees, but it's sheeted back to us that we need to resource our compliance people. I'm not blaming our compliance people. They do a fantastic job. I think we need to review timeframes that we act on things in our compliance. I think, you know, to have 40 cars and rubbish everywhere, I drive around. Mine's completely opposite to Councillor Edwards' area. His is largely a rural thing on the islands and stuff like that, and no one councillor could possibly be up every dry gully having a look around. But certainly I think our compliance, we need to resource our compliance, and we need to resource our conservation people. And I do not follow the thing where, you know, less trees is less fire impact than that. We need to manage our property, but certainly in the regard of residents need to manage their property. And I'm quite aware Councillor Talty is driving for rural fire things and stuff like that. But however, if I bring you to page 69 of the book, it says, as a general observation, most households in both Mount Cotton and Sheldon present reasonably well, with houses generally well cared for and maintained to a standard that would likely prevent significant property loss in normal fire conditions of under FD120. FD120 is what the fire guys are recommending. So FDI or whatever. Okay. However, both suburbs are primarily located in semi-rural conservation areas that will always present an elevated risk from wildfire in FDI climates, if that's it, with the danger proportionally increasing with FDI levels. No amount of planning or preparation will ever guarantee protection of life and property from the effects of fire, but implementing regular and seasonal inspection, maintenance to houses, that's your own, and properties will reduce the probability of significant impact. The following examples were identified during ground truthing activities, and I think the guys that were here, the fire guys that were here, actually said the fire trails in their drive around were good in the Mount Cotton Sheldon area yesterday. These examples do not imply that all houses in the area share the identified issues, nor does it imply that the photographs are the only houses with those concerns. Overgrown vegetation around houses and over roofs, poor maintenance of gutters and household surrounds, build up of leaves, twigs, bark and other debris from roof and gutters, poor access to structures due to long narrow driveways, overhanging trees, security gates, house address numbering that is not visible from the roadway, structures built prior to 2009 not meeting current standards, will present a much reduced level of survival, LP gas cylinder not incorrectly installed. So these are things you do yourself. When I grew up, we did every year. It was the winter to summer job was checking the leaves and out of the gutters and stuff. People aren't doing it. There's pages of them. You've got to look after yourself in this, you know. We have a responsibility to come and check on you, but certainly people have to do it. So there's nothing here that's telling me we're doing it all right, but certainly on the Simbi, we need to resource that, and we spend buckets and buckets and buckets of money on new infrastructure and all stand in front of the cameras, but we certainly need to get back to basics we're always banging on about just checking on the fire loads in our own conservation areas and on properties and sending letters out, and those things we need to address with other levels, fine. But if I was a resident, it's about what you can do for me. And I think that's what we need to do, certainly.
Thank you. I think you go through just about every page in this report and pick out something and talk to it, and I'm not going to do that. The spotlight is certainly on us now. We've got the report, which is a good thing. But I'd also like to say that this report, I believe, is shared ownership with the community. This just doesn't rest with us. I'm confused about a couple of things. One in particular, the amount of dumping that's going on the islands, and we've got free transfer station where people can take their rubbish and put it there for free. So that is laziness, and for me that is really disrespecting the others in your community for not doing it. So we need to police that and enforce it. I do have a concern that I've witnessed that some commercial operators are instead of who have to pay for using our transfer stations and not using it and stockpiling green wastes on properties, and I've reported them to council to have them cleaned up. It seems we've got some actions there we need to follow through. What are our legalities and responses we can do for that? I know out of this there's going to be a focus on people managing their own lands to make sure they don't present fire risks. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that council is the largest landholder on the islands, and we have lots of land that is right up to the borders of homes, and we need to be seen managing our own lands as well. It's no good just going out and saying to the privately owned lands, hey, look after this, we've got to do ours. And finally, the last issue, because this has been something that's been going on for years and it's been a problem, is there are a number of houses that hoard things. There have been plenty of examples on all islands where the entire yard is just taken up with, well, they say one man's junk is another man's treasure. Let's say their treasure, and that does present real risk. And the difficulty that I've trying to understand is that we appear to be ineffectual in their legal process to take actions against people. So I think there's another further discussion of it's easier to say council should get in there and do an enforcement notice, but the time involved and the legal restraints is going to present us some challenges. So I think that needs to be communicated to the community. What are the steps? What are the challenges? And maybe there's space there which we should be engaging our state members to instigate some change in legislation to enable us to be more effective in managing these properties. But again, thanks for the report. There's a lot in it. I think every time I read it, I pick out something new.
Councillor Hewlett.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I tend to agree with Councillor Elliott and Councillor Edwards on their comments. I've had land on the Bay Islands for nearly 30 years, first on Carrigarra, now on Lamb Island. The issue over there isn't so much like the broad-scale acreages you've got around Mount Cotton and Sheldon. You've got 500 square metre lots across those whole islands, and they're just in pure bushland, some of them. And I think, and I mentioned it yesterday, there should be a planning trigger that when someone builds on one of those blocks, that it's onus upon the other owners around them to clear the understory and to create a firebreak around these people. I mean, some of those houses are at real risk, and we're going ahead and approving a development on a block that could be that isolated and surrounded by bushland, and you know, it's really got no fire protection. And it needs, I don't know how it gets implemented, whether it's through the planning scheme or whether it's through the building certification process, but something needs to protect those islands. There's a lot of small blocks right in the middle of bushland over there, and I've driven around nearly every road on Russell Island. I can tell you some of them are in extreme danger. I mean, it's a real concern. And I think that's why Simbi is different to the mainland, because they're just small lots amongst massive conservation and rural areas. I remember when I had land on Carrigarry years ago, if I didn't mow that block within 3 months, I was getting a letter from council saying you'll be hit with a $200 fine if you don't go and do it. And I used to ring a guy in Maclay Island who went over and slashed it for me. So I don't know whether that system's still in place within our compliance, and I don't want to put a financial burden on the Simbi people, but I think something needs to be done from every angle, not just compliance, self-management, but also I agree with Councillor Edwards that council needs to step up and start maintaining the blocks that's particularly adjacent to where people are living and their properties, and I believe that we can go down that path. And that's all I'll say. Thank you.
Councillor Golay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your permission, am I allowed to ask some questions on this report? Yeah? Okay, so through the Chair, my questions are directed to Mr. Lolbach, if that's okay. And I refer to the document Training and Emergency Management Unit. It's page 28, and it's scope point 1.5. And it says limited initial emergency response personnel and equipment on each of the Simbi islands. And I'll leave it there. So my question is whose jurisdiction does that fall under, and who manages that recruitment and training of the personnel that are acting as those initial response people?
Sorry, we'll put it down here.
Madam Mayor, Councillor. The comments that were made in there initially were directed at the Rural Fire Brigade on the islands and the fact that they were under-resourced and everything else, but you've got to remember that the discussions that occurred as part of this review were with the individual agencies on the island who were looking to better resource themselves for the attempts they have. We've worked with the agencies and spoken to their command structures to have a look at what they're doing, what the council levy payment goes towards, and what Queensland Fire is actually implementing in terms of their actions. And I bring to your attention also that this time last year there was a standing order change in Queensland Fire that adopted that they would now be responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of all their vehicles. Council chose, at the request of Commissioner Katarina Carroll, not to change our levy amounts, so that there would be more capacity for the brigades to undertake other duties across the islands. The brigades themselves, when you speak to a lot of the members, would like to see better, but they are quite well resourced. During Exercise Exodus, which was conducted earlier this year, we took the opportunity to engage with the multiple level of emergency services across the island to demonstrate capacity, etc., and to try and alleviate some of the problems with cross-island travel. To give you an example, we found during the Russell Island fires, there were members of the Rural Fire Brigade that were waiting for commercial ferries to move them from one island to another. And later some criticism arose that we didn't make any efforts to move them. The reality of it was we didn't know they needed moving because no one told us. So the reality of it is now what we put into place is a process where we are able to work across multiple services, and we've already instigated a program with Volunteer Marine Rescue and the Coast Guard to have better capacity to move people between the islands. So the short answer to your question is, when it comes to the SES, Council has a very real role in ensuring that they have the capacity to be able to deliver, and we feel that we've done that to the highest standard. When it comes to Rural Fire, that is directly the responsible of Queensland Fire and Emergency Services. So some of the comments that are made in the report are going to be reviewed in terms of, have they got the capacity? Or are we simply looking at individual opinion that might indicate that they haven't? And that's one of the reasons we need some time to really work through exactly what is there. Do not lose sight of the fact that it was an individual Rural Fire Brigade that brought the fire on Russell Island in November under control, and they were there alone for 3 hours to fight that fire and did so incredibly well.
That's right.
So no, they are an extremely capable unit.
Yeah, and that's why I asked a question about whose jurisdiction do those volunteers fall under, because they're acting in a diligent capacity, but are they actually under-resourced, and do they need further training? Do they need more support? I suppose that's the real crux of it.
So I think the answer has been that for rural fires, that's a responsibility of QFES.
Yes, yeah.
Just state, though, that you'll find that many of the volunteers who are in rural fire will also be volunteering in other sort of emergency services, emergency services such as SES.
It's just making sure that those people have the boots on the ground and the equipment and the support they need. Yeah. So my second question is on page 29 in the same document. And it refers to no workable secondary evacuation routes at all on each of the Simbi Islands. My question is, with our intelligence from on-ground operations, how would we as a council physically choose a secondary route for an emergency route, given that we're relying on the hour-by-hour information and intelligence coming in from the guys on the ground, weather patterns changing, wind changing, etc.? How would we go and pick a secondary route if the primary route is compromised?
I'll refer to Michael Oldback, but this is why we have a local disaster management group on the ground and some plans in place that we refer to that are pretty standard, but Mike can probably tell you about that. I would encourage any councilor to come to an operation to see how that actually rolls out on the day. But, Mike, would you like to respond?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Councillor, again, I'll refer back to Operation Exodus, and it became very apparent to us that there was some community angst following the fires with what they considered to be an inability to be able to move across the island. And yes, the report does allude to the fact that in 1996 there was a recommendation for a second route of travel. And I have said in forum in my discussion with the Queensland Fire, in 1996 another recommendation might have been that every house has a VHS video recorder in it. So I think in fairness, what we have to look at is the fact that as the world and technology has changed, capacity has changed. What we found during Operation Exodus, we were able to effectively evacuate 50 people from the southern end of the island using water transport to move them to the top end. We've been trialling some roll-out mats that go across the mud flats that people can move across, similar to a tank track that rolls out, that are in use at different places. We are looking for alternatives to be able to move people, because you made a very, very good comment and a very real comment in disaster management. And I will allude back to the 2009 bushfires in Victoria. The bulk of deaths that occurred during evacuation on evacuation routes of travel, not people in their homes, etc. It was people trying to get out by simply following the route that they believed was the appropriate one to follow. Mm. We have to be very careful not to simply establish a simple route of travel and have people take it without proper information. We have a very, very strong policy across our disaster management group to watch and wait until information is provided to you about the appropriate way to act during an emergency, and that is simply to ensure that we can fully assess circumstances and not put people into imminent danger.
Yes, because we actually don't want to create confusion by setting up multiple access routes and then people are trying to second-guess a route when it could actually change given the face of the fire and the weather, etc., hour by hour. And that's where we need to have a strong communications platform to actually notify people as we move.
And mobile phone coverage.
Yeah. So, I mean, in Operation Exodus, Mike, did you exercise the fact that the primary route was compromised and had to move to a secondary?
Yes, we did.
Thank you.
During Operation Exodus, we basically indicated that it was... That the route had been compromised by downed trees, and that we were unable to move across the island. And we utilised SES, Volunteer Marine Rescue, Police, Surf Life Saving, to move some of our actors to the top end of the island, which was done incredibly successfully. And I do acknowledge, for those people that will question it, the tides on the southern Moreton Bay Islands are, to say the least, difficult. And so that's why we're exploring other options. We have a whole of island evacuation plan in conjunction with the Southern Moreton Bay Island ferries, and we have specific SES flat bottom boats with front drop capacity that can come onto those mud flats to move people. We don't necessarily advertise those things again in the normal circumstances until the circumstances require them, Otherwise, we create unnecessary angst for people if they turn up thinking there's going to be a boat and one doesn't turn up. So
okay.
We very much look at circumstances.
All right. And then just finally, on private land, just for the record, whose responsibility is it to maintain private land and fire mitigation?
Under the Queensland Fire and Emergency Services Act, it's every individual's responsibility to ensure that their land is fire safe. That includes necessary clearing and maintenance of the land right the way through to smoke, workable smoke alarms.
Okay.
So when it comes to private land, I think the discussion is quite well, and it's been readily put in the discussions I heard earlier. Council's focus should be on being the good neighbour and ensuring that we are maintaining our land to the highest possible standing, and then enforcing the fact that people should be at least meeting that standard. And it's not lost on me that the free tipping situation is still seeing an awful lot of rubbish being dumped by people, and that's something that needs to be worked on.
All right, fantastic. Excellent. Thanks, Mike. No more questions, Madam Mayor. Thank you.
Councillor Mitchell.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. When we're discussing human safety and property safety, there's probably no more serious discussion we can have as the people's representatives. So certainly acknowledge the report that's come in, and I don't think any one of us in this room will shy away from some of the recommendations, and if some of those things point towards council, that's great. I'm sure we'll all diligently deal with those looking ahead. I've just been so impressed and grateful to our disaster management teams in the time I've been in this office, and I just want to just say that to the community. We've got a great team. We've got some great processes in place, and while there's been some shortfalls perhaps identified, it's not all on council, but council will take its responsibility. But I think we've got a great team in place, and I've been very impressed with what I've seen to date. I think also, without taking the focus away from Simbi, if I comment on North Stradbroke, the cross-agency group and the cooperation that's been shown over there, and I discuss this from time to time with Michael Oldback, is perhaps a great model where, you know, across various agencies, level of government, that we should expect no less, but that's perhaps been a good model that we can pursue. I think the report has helped us identify quite clearly what are the issues and what's the desired outcomes. So we've now got that in place. The how, and we've all been quite passionate about some of the things and picked parts out of the report, but that's going to be determined by some of the wonderful internal and external resources and the real experts that we've got at our fingertips who, as we've heard today, are all keen to help us, are all keen to line up and get involved. So I think that's really encouraging. So the how, the technical side, whether it's legal reviews, council, other government agencies, individuals, more resourcing, all that'll wash out. And I think some strategic urgency based on some great expert advice is the right way forward. So I'm encouraged. Don't shy away from the report and its recommendations, but I'm really encouraged, and I'm sure we'll continue to improve. And as I said, no more important thing we discuss than human safety. Thank you.
Councillor Boglari.
We were joking with the fireys yesterday about how one document you just simply can't understand, and the other one has got all the information in that we need. But I think the second document, the one with all the technical, is actually, it just shows the depth that they've gone into. So we do need to thank them for that, and we also need to thank our local disaster management team, because it's obvious that it's a multi-agency approach. Council's got some socks to pull up, and so is the community across Redlands, that we've all got to take our own responsibility. I just wanted to clarify, when they're talking about the EZ zones, and in the presentation today, they talked about council going into what we have got as EZ zones, and they're no fire zones. That doesn't mean we're not doing maintenance in them. It just means we're not using fire burning, or whatever the technical term is. We're just not using that as our maintenance. We're actually still going in there and slashing them and doing the other types of maintenance. It just means we're not using that. So I just wanted to clarify that, because it's...
Point of order, Madam Mayor. I don't know that that's entirely correct.
Well, that is how it was clarified to me yesterday when I asked the question.
I'll ask just a clarification from Michael Holbach. I think that was...
Yes, Madam Mayor, that is the case. You might remember when Lex Smith, the Group Manager of City Spaces, addressed the council yesterday during the workshop. He mentioned that the fire exclusion zones were exclusively for live fire, for prescribed burning, that maintenance work did occur within them. However, maintenance work in those areas was also tempered by the regeneration of certain areas, etc. So it must be acknowledged at the same time that whilst work is happening in there, they probably do represent some of their more vulnerable areas with heavier fuel loads than would be acceptable.
And that's what I was going on to say, because a lot of those areas on the island that have that zoning are actually in swamp. So when the QFES was saying that they didn't have access, and I probably would direct this to our CEO, they didn't have access into these areas, it was clarified to me later. It's because a lot of these areas are swamp, and that's why council hasn't got access in there. So I presume that's one of our actions that we're taking as to how we can get greater access to them. And so I think this is what has come out of the report, is that we've been doing council business, but we've now just got to up it, because over the years our conservation areas are, you know, regenerating, and so therefore we've got to change our methods. I agree with Councillor Elliott that perhaps we also need to look at increasing our resources into that conservation area so that they can do a more appropriate job, and also to our compliance, because obviously compliance action needs to be taken in some cases. And I thought also, yesterday I got clarification again, perhaps to you, Mike, that under the legislation, QFES, if there is a private property, under legislation they can actually go in. And I know it's a bit of a tough stick approach, but QFES can go into private property, can't they, under legislation?
Yes, they can. Under legislation, QFES are allowed to go on if they see an immediate fire threat. Late last year, QFES officers and council officers attended premises on North Stradbroke Island to issue a direction. The biggest issue on that particular place was that there was some high fuel stuff and inflammable materials being held. An order was never issued by QFES on that property because the residents responded to the visit by council officers and QFES in those circumstances. So, yes, however, they will not simply attend an untidy block. They will send that back to council, or even a block where there is hoarding on place, unless they determine that there is an imminent fire threat. But there is power under the legislation to deal with that.
And then the other point that came up was how our residents didn't quite understand our disaster management policy or our laws. So that to me says more education, more discussing it with them. And I have to say that the QFES came to Ormiston House and gave a brilliant talk to all the volunteers one day about fire safety in their own homes. They also showed up at Relay for Life and handed out brochures on fire alarms and everything, so I know that they do that. Our disaster management team, they were over on Coochie just on the weekend, and you guys were really busy, the amount of questions I know you got that day. They also came down to Relay for Life. So I know that both QFES and our disaster management team is proactive in our education, but perhaps we need to support you more in that role. But also we've got a couple of rural fire brigades that we are able to get in on this as well. Previously in workshops, QFES have stated how the Carbrook Rural Fire Brigade is available to our Mount Cotton residents for education purposes and things like
Point
that.
Point of order, Madam Mayor, if I wasn't allowed to speak to Rural
Thank
Fire...
Thank you, Councillor.
If I can
Thank
finish
you,
my
just,
sentence...
Just sticking to the report, Councillors, I think that would be fair.
I am. I'm saying how out of the report, education has actually come as a very important part. So we have these two Rural Fire Brigades, and
Councillor,
one of their main... I wanted to talk about Simbi, the Rural Fire Brigade.
I'm just trying to be consistent here. I think if we can just come back, we understand education.
Well, I'm not
important.
Talking about the vote or the reasons why we voted the way we did that day.
I'm just talking about the educational reasons.
Neither
was the councillor that was a point of order was called on. So
I'll jump over the bay to Simbi. The Rural Fire Brigade over on Simbi, maybe that needs to be one of their jobs as well, is in the educational to help Councillor Edwards Council and QFES help the residents there. I wanted to ask you, Mike, can we possibly, through disaster management, help the Rural Fire Brigade and any other that might be helping our city with this education?
Madam Mayor, through you. I think it's important to note here that the Street Speaks program we use, I unashamedly say we stole from the Rural Fire Brigade.
Okay.
We basically adapted their programs, and across the southern Moreton Bay Islands at all the Street Speak sessions we've been running, some of which have been attended by Councillor Edwards, we have members of the Rural Fire Brigade working with us. So we have implemented a multi-agency approach to the way we're delivering these services.
And I think that's what came out, that we've all got to take a responsibility. It's a multi-agency approach. And we've all just got to pull up our socks. And I know that the CEO is already onto a lot of them. And those that we weren't, there's going to be that report back to us, which we all said yesterday, you know, we wanted to see got back to us as soon as possible, because safety is, as Councillor Mitchell said, very important to us. So thank you.
Thanks, Councillor Borghalari. Just quickly, if I could perhaps just reflect back to the 18th of December, where I stood in front of a group of residents from southern Moreton Bay Island and made a commitment to them that we would address each and every one of their concerns. And certainly it was very apparent to me that when I asked them to put their hands up as to who had read our disaster management plan, that's actually designed for their community, that there's the southern Moreton Bay Islands disaster management plan, where we're certainly well regarded across the nation, if not just the state, in regards to those plans. And it was despairing for me to see maybe one or two people out of a group of 100 put their hand up. This is a timely reminder once again that there's only so much that government can do in helping you protect your property and your life, and we need your assistance by being informed, and those documents are available. And certainly we ran out of documents on that day, so at least half of that room when they left that meeting had a disaster management plan, but we forwarded on to others who hadn't. So I made that commitment, and I guess this review is a result of that. I make another commitment today, working with the CEO, that we will review these recommendations. I have to say, though, you know, the recommendations are quite black and white, and you might find that some of those things, some of those recommendations, we will respond to, and we won't actually act upon. You need to be prepared for that because of all the complexities that we've already discussed around the room. But at the same time, we take each and everyone seriously, and we are committed to doing our role as local government in protecting our entire community, and particularly I'd like to refer to our islands. And I just want to perhaps reflect back as to why Redland City Council sits in this position. It's been a long journey. This is not this council, this term of council's issue. It's a legacy issue, and if we look at some of those maps that were once upon a time subdivided and sold to people in other parts of Australia, and over a long period of time, council has been buying back those properties with little or no assistance from any other level of government. So we've done that because we can't afford to deliver the infrastructure for the population of that particular subdivided community back then in the 70s. So though we've actually tried to deal with an issue, what's happened is another issue has organically grown, because we own significant parcels of land. To protect the environment, we bought that land back. So I just want to remind the community that this hasn't just happened overnight. It has been a tremendously long and often painful journey for this community in acquiring those islands and making sure that they are safe and they have a sustainable, environmentally secure future, as well as the lifestyle, which is so important to each and every one of us. So I would like to say to that point that this isn't going to be an overnight solution. You've heard the discussions about the financing required and the resourcing. So to expect that every single one of those recommendations, A, would potentially be accepted, which is likely not to happen, and B, be implemented in the next 3 months is not feasible. However, as you've already been told, we are already, as a result of that fire and responding to the fire and through our disaster management processes, we have already started to respond organically to those issues. So it's going to take time, but it's going to take time in partnership with everyone else who is responsible for the safety and the lifestyle of our communities here in Redlands on Southern Moreton Bay Island. We have a legacy issue that we inherited from a state government. We have infrastructure that is the responsibility of the federal government, and we need to work with them to make sure that they are picking up their can, as we are, for the future of our Southern Moreton Bay Islands. It's a warts and all report, and it's not all about council. And as has already been said, that as a result of other discussions we've had about Southern Moreton Bay Islands, we've already written to ministers and to director generals, and we are going to conduct a roundtable. Councillor Bishop referred to affordability, and you'll find that most people in this city who are looking for affordable housing might think about living on the Southern Moreton Bay Islands without the insight of the fact that the cost of living and travelling from the islands is actually quite expensive. It leaves them in a position where they have no other alternative, and we have to take care of those people as well. We have a social obligation to making sure when we take compliance that we are doing it in a way that allows them to continue to live somewhere safe. So I just also want to remind councillors and the community that there is always, always tension between our environment and fire safety. It's there, and there always will be. And sometimes the pendulum might go one way or the other, and ultimately we're trying to find middle ground. I refer to Councillor Hewlett's talking about what is building legislation. Here is another complexity that local governments face where we have zero control ultimately over building legislation. Often it's left to private certifiers. And so here, once again, being the closest level of government to the community and the first people it's reported to, often our hands are tied, as they were tied when we inherited a group of subdivided islands with no infrastructure and spent decades buying it back, not even getting subsidies or acknowledgement of the stamp duty that we provided to the state to buy that land back, and looking to pay for infrastructure. But it also, once again, highlights a discussion that I've been having across government levels in regards to the anomaly, the opportunities and the challenges that we have with Southern Moreton Bay Islands here in southeast Queensland. Because unfortunately, when people think of Redland City, they think of us being part of Brisbane. We try to educate them on that often, and that's why we're going through a branding exercise. But what they don't realise is that we have these isolated communities with, you know, regional challenges when it comes to employment, accessibility, connectivity, right here in southeast Queensland. And it's something I've been banging the table about for a long time and will continue to do that. And this, once again, has highlighted that, and certainly will be in the correspondence, continuing correspondence with those levels of government to let them understand that we, as a small city, have a group of islands that maintain a great residential population that need the support that regional and outback communities have. And so that's something that will continue. And it's been once again highlighted by the fact that we don't have enough appliances on an island 35 kilometres away from Brisbane to deal with wildfires. So there's lots of learnings in this. I make my commitment that we will work with the CEO to keep those progress reports on time for councillors to know that things are happening. We're not waiting for the next fire season. We are doing things now. I also make a commitment to those recommendations that council will commit to. That I personally will be asking the questions of the organisation as to how quickly and how effectively and efficiently they're delivered. And that doesn't just apply to the Southern Moreton Bay Islands. We acknowledge that it's occurring on the mainland. And for my personal value in life, I do actually want to make sure we value the security and life of people in this city beyond and above all things. So it's a warts and all report. We'll work with it, and like I said, it's not something that we just happened overnight. It's a legacy, and it's a legacy that will take a little while to address, but I think around the room we're committed to doing that. Thank you, Mike, and once again, thanks to QFES, and we look forward to now being able to move on with this, like this afternoon. So thank you, and I'll hand back to Councillor Edwards to sum up. Councillor, I'll need to have a motion to resume meeting proceedings. Thank you. Move Councillor Edwards, seconded Councillor Bishop. Thank you. All right, back to the beginning. Item 11.1.1 on the agenda is the long-term asset management plan, and Councillor Mitchell, I believe you were going to move that motion.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Yeah, I'd like to move item 11.1.1, the Long-Term Asset and Service Management Plan 2017.
Move, Councillor Mitchell. Seconded, Councillor Boglari. Would you like to speak to it, Councillor Mitchell?
Yes, please. Yeah, this is a very important body of work that's going on, looking at, I think of it as a $2 billion stock take across our organisation, and has implications for not just the assets, but of course our budget, year by year by year. So I just thought I might ask through you to either Pete Best or Deb Corbett-Hall, who's heading up this plan, to just give us a bit of an update on what's a complex process and the next steps that the organisation is taking to continue it on its way. Thank you.
Deborah, would you like to deal with that?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Through you, Chair, thank you for the opportunity, Councillor. This report that's tabled today is almost at a point in time. So the Local Government Act and regulation requires Council to have a long-term asset service management plan. This document today is not trying to replace that, because this is just a financial forecast, but it all forms part of the asset and service management plan project. So it gives me great pleasure to say that the colleague on my right, General Manager Infrastructure and Operations, we both sit on the steering committee of the asset management project. And moving forward, we're actually allocating some funds to train our colleagues in the coming months around writing better asset and service management plans. So the information in those asset service management plans will then form the 10-year capital program, as we know, and associated operational spend. So that's coming up between now and the end of the calendar year. It's all part of the broader asset project plan, and I'm delighted to announce that Financial Services will be tabling a suite of reports at the August 23rd general meeting that captures what Council endorsed on the 22nd of March. So in terms of the governance, the asset management framework, we now have a policy, and we've also got a organisational change management plan. So an awful lot of good work's been done across the organisation over the last few months, and we look forward to tabling that in the coming weeks. Thank you.
Anything else, Councillor, that you've asked? Do you need the General Manager Infrastructure Operations to respond as well, or you're satisfied with that response?
No, quite comfortable with that, and just like to add my thanks to the ELT and the other councillors for all getting behind this very, very important body of work being done.
Thank you. Any speakers against, councillors? There being none? Comments? Okay. Wendy? Councillor Boglari, sorry.
Oh, no, through you, I just wanted to thank the officers for this amount of work, because it's probably not the sexiest department in council going out and doing all the asset management planning and that, but with $58 million depreciation a year, when Councillor Mitchell and I recently presented at the Raby Bay Association, and they were really stunned, weren't they, that we had $2.5 billion worth of assets and we had that amount of depreciation. And I think that just shows the importance of this work. And though this is the financial, it's quite interesting, the graphs, if anyone has time to actually see how they relate to each other, the ongoing capital works and what's renewal and what's ongoing maintenance and how it affects it. It's quite interesting, actually, Deb. And so I'd just like to say thank you to them, because this is, if we find efficiencies here, this is going to help our financials every year. And without the financials, we can't do anything, including fire mitigation and everything. So it's very important work. So thank you.
Yeah, look, this is the sexiest thing we do. We spend buckets of money on this stuff. We've got a couple of billion dollars worth of assets. Stormwater, if you ever stuck your head down a stormwater, it's great. It explains a lot. Thank you, Councillor. I think we have a long way to go. You know, I remember years ago we actually had asset management plans. We actually had the titles in place, and that was it. And I thought we had asset management plan, but you can see even on page 16 of the report, yeah, our planned and our predicted miles apart. What we think we got and what we don't. But we need to get right back to the basics and make everything we got. Set a year on it, do that. We need resources because we're spending other people's money and mine, and our asset maturity, you know, we have these little indexes and things like that. We have a target, but we haven't got a date on the target, and this is an evolving process, but certainly year by year it's getting better and better. But I certainly want to see the plan and the predictions come closer together as we roll through. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Councillor Bishop.
Two things. First of all, just a reminder to the community that while we've talked about the $2 billion that is the written down value, the replacement cost of the whole assets that we have across the city is $3.3 billion. So that's the sum total of the infrastructure that exists across this city that the citizens get to enjoy, rely upon, and in certain instances their life depends on, certainly for travel to and from islands and so forth. And there's a lot of it there, so appreciate the significance of this. And an alert to kids, don't do as Councillor Elliott says, we're sticking your head down drains. But I just want to ask a question, if I may, through you, Madam Mayor, to Chief Financial Officer. There was a question that was raised by Councillor Elliott yesterday. In terms of the on the graph on page 13, which is the combined maturity assessment infrastructure assets, it's got a stretch target, but it just doesn't have a year associated with that. I appreciate...
Explained underneath on the... It actually says that they need to do more work before they determine that date.
Yeah, I just want to... so there's two parts to the question. One is about that work, and the second one is how are we, as council, ensuring that we get the feedback from our community about the significance of the assets that they rely upon? Officers I know are doing their assessments on compliance-based stuff, but just where are the areas of significance in terms of managing? How are we getting the feedback loops from the residents in informing our decision-making?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Through you, Chair, thank you for the opportunity, Councillor. I'll go through them. I think there's three questions there, so I'll do them one at a time. In terms of the target, Council may recall on the 22nd of March we tabled a project plan, and as part of the project plan we're looking at a two-year implementation process. At the end of that, there's a product going to be called an implementation plan, and that will outline when Council believes it will achieve that target zone. So as we know, the target zone may change depending on how we build the capacity and the capability in the organisation, and also our maturity. So in terms of a time frame, I'm happy to commit to say by the end of the calendar year 2018, we'll have an indication of how long Council will need to implement the data cleansing, et cetera, the training organisation to get to that target zone. So I think that's question number one. In terms of community consultation, my desire is for council and council officers to get a better understanding of our assets and our data through doing a data cleansing project, then looking at the system, so purchasing some software, designing some software, whatever that outcome is. Once we have that information and we have better understanding of our data, that will be the trigger to go to community consultation. So when we can have reliance on our data to talk to the community around service levels, what does the community want as services for the assets in our system, and then we can respond to that to say it will come at a cost. I'd like a better handle on our data. We know that the data is materially sound because the QAO audits it every year, but we can certainly improve on that. So I think in terms of that project plan that Council endorsed on the 22nd of March, we're going to get the governance piece and the framework done and the responsibility in the organisation. That's going to be tabled at the end of August to you for your consideration as our board. Next steps will then be looking at the data. We need to clean up the data before we purchase a system, a computer product. Once we get it into the system, then we're happy to talk about community consultation. So it's all part of the grand plan.
Great. Just acknowledging that this is a part of an ongoing body of work that I'm very keen, and I know other councillors are too, to ensure the long-term management of this entire estate, which is our city and the infrastructure in it. And when we've questioned previously the asset sustainability ratio as a measure, this is a part of an ongoing series of works that I'm grateful to see progressing, and it's great to have in the capable hands of Deb and the team and officers assessing the quality of and condition of assets across the city. A great report. Good to see it. Thank you.
Thanks, councillors. I'll just make one point, and I think it's a really important one, and I think Councillor Elliott may have demonstrated or illustrated the maturity of the organisation and how asset management has, I I guess, grown over, the reliance on asset management has grown. There is cultural change required. I mean, relating the fact that we struggle, you know, when we look at operating deficits, that in fact having a great asset management plan with reliable data will help us manage that is something that perhaps 20 years ago we weren't considering. But that's the impact. It doesn't just have an impact on the people in our city using the infrastructure, some of which, most of which we probably don't even see. But it also is how we manage our finances and replacement, et cetera. So I think we live in exciting times, and in some ways to be able to mature this particular part of our business as usual in this century is great, because, you know, you have technology out there that can do a lot of the footwork, and it's happening in other parts of the world, some of that I'll talk about when I present to you on Singapore. But, you know, we live in exciting times where we can actually implement technology to help us manage our assets a lot more effectively than we did 2 years ago, let alone 20 years ago. So that culture and that maturity is coming, and I think it comes at a good time. And certainly it is our core business to manage the assets of our community, that balance sheet. Handing back to Councillor Mitchell to sum up, if necessary.
Easy. Thank you, Madam Mayor. Yep, I think in summing up, we've councillors and ELT are all in step on this important bit of work. It's been recognised as very important. It's ongoing. It's urgent. There's technical aspects, cultural aspects, perhaps need for lots of resources or more resources, maybe not lots, but specific resources. The organisation, looking back, has recognised that, yep, we could have done better. But action is being taken, importantly, and looking forward, I think we can all be very proud of where we're heading and the outcome that's going to be achieved. Thank you.
Councillor, put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? Motion's carried unanimously. Item 11.1.2 on the old agenda. Move Councillor Boglari. Seconded Councillor Bishop. I'd like to speak to it. Councillor Boglari.
Thank you, through you. The monthly financial report for June shows the actual financial performance at this point in time. It is based on the interim financial results prior to finalisation of the end of year. So I just wanted to make sure people didn't realise that this actually was the end of year figures. We do expect some significant movement, and the annual report is the one to, and the audited financial statements are the one to actually get clarification on any final end of year figures. The year-to-date interim operating surplus of $800,000 exceeded the budgeted deficit by $4.57 million, and that's on page 8 of 14. And this is due to expenses being recorded in the correct financial year, operating grants and subsidies of $3.59 million being received earlier than expected. Capital works expenditure, however, is $15 million behind. And I was just going to ask through you, Madam Mayor, if the general manager could actually speak to that one, and also any clarification they think should be given about the difference in the operating surplus at the moment.
Thank you, Madam Mayor, Deputy Mayor. The total of $83.824 million is for the total program of capital works in this business. I can certainly talk to the infrastructure part of that, which is $68 million. We're in the process of finalising the carryovers for the infrastructure, and in fact the carryovers for all of the capital works for this financial year. Other parts of the business clearly contribute to that. We won't have that information available to us until it's finalised in August. Correct, Deb?
First budget review.
Correct. Carryovers. And that will give you a very clear picture of where the business lands against its capital budget for last financial year.
Thank you. And I just wanted to make note on whatever page it was, where all the page 12 of 14, you read my mind, which is our interim constrained cash reserves. Councillors have previously, but also our internal audit department has just picked up that there's quite a few reserves there with large sums of money in them. and they're wondering if we're utilising those funds effectively, and that's being looked into at the moment, so to make sure that we use the funds as needed. And the special charge reserves down the bottom, they've actually been frozen, and they continue to be frozen. The only movement in them was actually money went back in to the Sovereign Lake due to some interest. So they're frozen, so there's been no movement there as we advised our residents. And that was the update on that one.
Thank you. Any speakers against? Comment?
As residents are very keen and watching where their infrastructure money is spent, and I had one little cul-de-sac that was missed out on some road reseal some years ago, and that group of residents were very keen to see that this financial year they had come up on the schedule, that their little road at Jasper and Gem Streets at Wellington Point would be resealed. What I'm going to say is we got through to the 29th of June and that road was not resealed, and I was starting to think, oh my goodness. Our guys turned up and that road was resealed in this financial year. Residents, not one, not two, five, six and seven in that little area have asked me to thank the team for that. Genuinely pass it through. Thank you. In this financial year, we came through. In the year we promised, we jolly well delivered right to the nth, 29-30 of June. Thank you.
Madam Mayor, there are 7 days in a week and 24 hours in a day, and we took it to the limit.
Yeah. All right, councillors. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm sure that the General Manager will pass that on to his road crew. With that, Councillor Boglari... We're ready to vote. Is that ready to vote? Okay. I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? The motion is carried. Councillor Tolte is absent. Okay. That takes us to item 11.2.1, which is the decisions under delegated authority. Councillor Hughes, I believe you were going to move that.
Thank you, Mayor. Delighted to move 11.2.1, decisions made under delegated authority for Category 1, 2 and 3 development applications, noting that these applications for the last 2 weeks, 25th of June through to the 8th of July. Thank you.
Move, Councillor Hughes. Seconded, Councillor Edwards. Would you like to speak to it further, Councillor Hughes?
Thank you. The report is there and for noting.
Any questions or comments, councillors? Question, Councillor Gollo.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I refer to page 6 of 6, MCU 013526, decisions made under delegated authority. Refer to Place Design Group Proprietary Limited. Under application, full details, there's actually nothing there. And the decision and description of what was actually applied for, there's nothing there in the report. So could I ask what's actually happening there, please?
That's potentially a question, I think, through to you, David.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Sorry, Councillor, can I just confirm which application that was?
MCU, the last one,
it's a consultancy. Councillor, I think I'll have to take that on notice. I think it's just an error in terms of the report preparation, but I'll take that on notice and come back to you.
Madam Mayor, this is 11.2.2, Planning and Environment Court Matters, current as at 13th of July. Just noting that we have a total of 6 outstanding matters that are proceeding to court or progressing in that direction, and that's just an update from officers.
Comment, Councillor Elliott.
Thank
Two, progressing is a word we're not using on number two. We're still waiting for the judgment on this block of land, the corner of Boundary and Panorama. I don't know if we can do anything as an organisation, but this is, seems an incredible... I don't want to beat the mob that was down at the end of Victoria Point that took 20-something years, but I think this has been rolling on since October last year on this decision. So I don't know if the officer, through you to David, can give us and throw any more light on it.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Well, certainly we could look to make inquiries, but the court will determine...
Still in the chambers, or is it live?
Just waiting for the judgment.
Yeah. Yep, I appreciate that, but that's what I'm saying. I'm just asking if there's anything we can do, because this seems to be taking an ordinary amount of time. And I'm disappointed, because we as a councillor have development happening in Kinross Road. I want to see how this is going to roll out, road issues and things like that. So certainly we need to know, hopefully soon. And the other one is I'm disappointed to actually see six, because I don't often comment on these particular ones, but these particular people do a great job, and I'm disappointed to see there's an appeal on that approval. I don't want to take it away from Barrow Group. They're quite entitled to object, but certainly that's a great, well-run business, and I'll be disappointed if it didn't continue.
Certainly fills opportunities for tourism accommodation in the city, which don't currently exist in broad scale. So any other comments? Being none, I put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. Councillors, there is no mayoral minute. I'll just quickly get my running sheet when I can find it. There is no mayoral minute, nor is there any notices of motion to repeal or amend, nor any urgent business without notice. But we do have, we have indicated a closed session, but my discussions, councillors, I think you were quite comfortable for us to move the recommendation in public session. I'll just double check that's still the case. Yes? Okay, so with that, we'll need a mover and a seconder for item 16.1.1. Before you do that, I'm just going to declare a perceived conflict of interest, as I have a donation to my political campaign from a waste collection company. So with that, I'll remove myself from a chair and ask the Deputy Mayor to take the chair for that. For that moment, before we move the motion.
Can I just ask a question, please?
Sure.
Councillor Hewlett actually has a question, and I'm not too sure then whether we're going to have to go into closed.
On this issue?
I just have a question about the conflict itself. Should we go
into closed? Oh, if you want to have then you'll have to go into closed session. Yeah. So would you like to move that we go into closed session, Councillor Hewlett? Move Councillor Hewlett, seconded Councillor Bishop. Those in favour? Those against? Okay, so those in favour is Councillor Boglari, Councillor Mitchell, Councillor Hewlett, Councillor Edwards, Councillor Elliott, Councillor Hughes, Councillor Bishop, Councillor Williams, those against Councillor Golay and Councillor Tolte. And with that, I'll ask the members of the public to remove themselves from the gallery while we discuss these confidential items.
As we're not going to discuss...
And now I just go refer to Councillor Hewlett and he leaves.
Councillor Hewlett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to declare a perceived conflict of interest on this particular item, and I think I should leave the room.
Okay. Is there someone who would like to move? Thank you, Councillor Elliott.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor. I'd like to move item 16.1.1.
Is there a seconder for that motion? Councillor Edwards. All in favour? Passed unanimously with...
Weren't you going to give me a chance to talk to
it? Oh, so...
Doesn't matter.
Well, you can...
It's the most significant contract council award, so...
Okay. But you can't talk to anything generally. Thank you.
Know the rules of engagement. All I'd like to say to the community, this is the most, and I'll stand corrected by the CFO, this is the most significant... Oh, he probably won't report it.
Is he still there?
No. Okay. I'll just say, I'd just like to bring to the community's attention that this is the probably the most significant, it is the most significant contract that council awards in the time I have. And remember, the last one was a significant one. This is a longer term contract. I think it's a great value that we've been able to leverage off bigger people. And that's how it is. If we can do this, it certainly saves big, big, big bucks. Unfortunately, we can't tell anybody how much we do save. Thank you.
Did anyone else want to have a comment? No? The team is all down the back, so I think on behalf of everybody, we need to give them a big thank you. Waste is an ever-increasing minefield, I think, for councils across southeast Queensland in many regards, and our team certainly is keeping us up to the forefront and doing a great job. So thank you, everybody, down the back. Now we'll put the vote. All in favour? Passed unanimously, and we'll now ask Councillor Hewlett and Councillor Williams to re-enter the room. Councillors, thank you. Leave the room for 2 minutes and up to item 16.1.2, which is also a confidential item. I'll ask a mover and seconder for that. Thanks. I think it was Councillor Tolte moving that. Councillor Edwards was seconding that. And with that, I'll put the motion. Those in favour? Those against? Motion is carried unanimously. Councillors, the item that's remaining now is for Councillor Edwards to present his report from his conference. Madam Mayor, I was just wondering if Councillor Edwards, it's really important that the community sees what value we get out of it, and he's gone to a lot of work preparing it, and even brought in a little plant. I'd like Brian Williams and that to maybe see it. Would Councillor Edwards like to hold it over till next time?
No, I'd
rather be there. All right. I just
thank
think
you, councillors. We are still in formal session. Thank you.
Turn that on. On the 2nd of July, I had the wonderful opportunity to attend the week-long 15th Islands of the World Conference, which this year was held at Kangaroo Island, South Australia. The International Small Islands Studies Association, which runs the conference, is a not-for-profit organisation whose objectives are to encouraging the network of small island communities to achieve improved outcomes in all areas relevant to island life. The conference was an academic conference with 150 delegates at Kangaroo Island attending, which included 75 people from international islands. Professor Godfrey Baldacchino from Malta is the president of IESA, chaired the conference, and on most days we had three parallel sessions running at the time, so there were three separate things at the same time. This meant that I was only able to attend a third of the 75 presentations. I decided to attend those presentations which I believe would have a specific opportunity, not only for the Bay Islands, but also for our mainland residents. In addition to the conference, I spent some time with the Kangaroo Island Council to try to learn of how they deliver to their community. And I also spent some additional days, at my own expense, visiting a handful of small mainland towns to see how they market themselves and ways they try to improve their local economies. There were several presentations at the conference which impressed me, not only for what worked on island communities, but more importantly, the decisions that some of the islands communities made that end up being detrimental. So sometimes it can be a case of be careful what you wish for. The time afforded for me today does not allow me to document all the presentations I attended. However, there was one in particular that left an impression on me. I'll talk to that in a second, but in regards to the Kangaroo Island Council, I learned an important lesson in community engagement and empowerment. The council embraces a philosophy where they empower local community groups to maintain council assets, such as toilet blocks, halls, etc., and they pay them to do so. The payment is less than it would be for council, but enough for the community groups to prosper from. From my observations, the services was of a high standard, and I believe it is a pathway that our council can look at, particularly at closed communities such as our islands or perhaps rural areas. At the conference, the plenary session that inspired me most was delivered by Dr. Murukasan Krishnapali from the island of Yap, the Federated States of Micronesia. The paper presented was titled Smart Urban Vegetable Gardening for Displaced Urban Populations in Small Islands of Micronesia. This presentation documented a transition of the populace dependent on foods that are highly processed with low nutritional value to the present position of eating healthy fresh fruit and vegetables that improve the community health. The obstacle of cost was a previous barrier to eating fresh vegetables. The island of Yap scenario has many similarities faced by our lower socioeconomic residents, whether they're on the islands or the mainland. The transition from a poor diet of processed food to fresh fruit and veggies was through developing a low-cost process to grow produce on small housing lots, particularly through vertical, slanted and potted gardens. We're not talking about ploughing the land or market garden type activities. It's about urbanised agriculture in limited spaces. This transition required a lot of research, time, effort and money to refine a deliverable low-cost process before engaging the community. And I'd like to say that this is step one to empower self-sufficiency. However, there's more to draw on. Some people will produce more than they can use. This can be a potential income stream for their family. However, few people know the best way to convert that surplus into an economic gain at the best price. In the midweek of the conference, I visited several Kangaroo Island businesses. The first I visited was Bella Vista Farms. What most people don't realise is that Kangaroo Island produces about $170 million per year through agricultural produce, and it's sold at a premium. Bella Vista grow wheat, amongst many other things, and 70% of the flour that is in Tim Tams come from Kangaroo Island. Wow. And they pay a premium price for it. What Bella Vista achieved was to convince approximately 90% of island farmers of all types of agricultural production that they are not competitors but partners. They branded a Kangaroo Island collaborative brand under which most of the Kangaroo Island products, tourism experiences and businesses work together to promote their region and value add to their products. They use the same logo. It underlines their uniqueness and differentiates themselves from other producers. Later that day, I also visited American River Oysters, and they were delicious, Raptor Domain, Emu Ridge Eucalyptus Farm, Megan Harvey Food and Wine, and Authentic KI for their wool showcase. All use the Kangaroo Collaborative brand. So step two for me is if you want to get a premium price, you need to work collectively within your community and assemble under one brand. If we share with our residents these lessons of how to grow organic foods, produce unique products or experiences, we can improve their value under a universal brand that sets our region apart. Branding, however, does not translate to sales unless you have a retail platform, and this is the biggest hurdle. On my self-funded exploration of the mainland, I visited Maggie Beer Farms. Yes. Maggie Beer is a well-known chef and has appeared on many TV programs. To my surprise, Maggie Beer Farm resembles more of a tourist retail outlet rather than a farm, but the experience is very well done. The farm not sold all things Maggie Beer, such as caramels and more caramels. Someone else got a sweet tooth. And pickles. But also products produced by others under the Maggie Beer brand label, such as wine. this is just bottled for them. Not a bad drop, a bit expensive. Such as wine, cheese, etc. And these are some of the examples I've got. There's also a coffee shop. There are many employment opportunities in this business, not just a coffee shop, but also in marketing, product development, and more. It's a true tourist destination in itself. So step three for me is creating outlets for the new, for the unique products produced. So bring all three elements together, we need the following. A proven process to confidently engage with local residents to undertake agricultural activities that benefit themselves, but also provide an economic opportunity. We also need to have communal branding to differentiate the products and services within the market. And finally, we need retail outlets and marketing to deliver the sales. All of this is a long road and comes with costs. It's a journey rather than a sprint. So I could end the presentation now and say thank you for the opportunity to attend, et cetera, but that does not rest easy with me. If I commit my role as a representative leader to the community, then I must do what I can do to transition what I have learnt from this conference to on-the-ground applications. I need to step out of the regulatory framework of government and into the private enterprise within community, where risk and reward is not underpinned with a safety net. On my return 2 weeks ago, I decided to take the first steps that were carried out on the island of Yap and have committed to spend the next 12 months designing and making low-cost vertical, horizontal and potted garden structures that will grow a variety of produce in order to see what grows best on the islands in pots and structures. A quantity of construction material suitable for fabrication into agricultural support structures has been delivered on site. Two island allotments have been selected as garden test sites, one on the waterfront and the other inland as the conditions differ on each. The planting of many vegetable crops and also nursery plants has commenced. Already, I have potted over 400 bungalow palms and have planted, and I will expand rapidly to so many other varieties. A relationship with a large wholesaler has been formed and has resulted in the acquisition of over 1,000 pot plants and 5,000 planter bags. In engaging with community, with members of the local community over the next 12 months, should produce a range of low-cost growing structures, plants and pots for residents to take up growing vegetables, herbs and fruit and any other plants they desire. The knowledge gained will assist and support them. It is important to also look at the opportunities for local cheese, butter, honey and other produce. And yesterday I spoke with the committee members of the Bay Islands Conservation Group, and we will look for ways to work collaboratively and share volunteer labour as a first point of collaboration. Looking forward, if this first step succeeds, we need to brand ourselves together in a way that Kangaroo Island has been successful. So I've registered two business names. The first is Bay Islands Pure, where all products and services on the Bay Islands that meet agreed standards can use the name and logo to add value to their product. I've also registered another name which sits above Bay Islands Pure, and that is Redlands Pure, where all things Redlands can reside. I hope that if we hold the highest standards of product authenticity under the Pure logo, we can market them as premium products. The final and most important steps is having outlets such as Maggie Beer Farm, but under the name of Redlands Pure or Bay Islands Pure. But that's a much harder step, but is an essential point in retailing that will assist to expand the tourism market and provide a point of difference for our city. However, that's in the distant future. At this time, as we can't market what we don't currently produce, that is why the decision has been made to start at the product development stage. This time next year, I'd like to present again on the success or failure of this endeavour. Everything we undertake has a risk, but an aversion to risk ensures failure. I can imagine that some of you might be thinking right now, I'm a bit crazy, it's not my job, or maybe just stop talking now, so I will, and just say the conference was rewarding and enlightening, and this won't be the last you'll hear about this venture. Thank you.
Well done, Councillor Edwards. We'll obviously have you table that report, and I'm going to close the meeting. We can certainly have questions afterwards because it's just a presentation. So thank you, Councillor Edwards, and I'll close the meeting at 12 p.m. Thank you.
So we're back at 1.